Nathan found Texas Ranger Bodie West in his office.
I'm glad you came by. Sit down.
From a desk drawer, the young ranger took a sealed brown envelope and handed it to Nathan. The name Stone was written on it in pencil, and with hands not quite steady, Nathan broke the seal and opened it. Within the envelope was a square of leather, folded in the middle. He unfolded it to reveal the famed Star in a Circle silver shield of the Texas Rangers. There was nothing else.
I was told that Captain Jennings sealed that for you the day before he died. The shield has a 3 on the back because he was the 3rd man to join the Rangers when they were organized in 1835. He had no family. It was his life.
My God, I can't believe it. I'll guard it with my life, but is it legal for me to have it?
It is. I made sure of that. Headquarters knows what you did for the captain, and after wearing that shield for 39 years, it was his privilege to do with it what he wished, and he wanted you to have it.
I really don't know what to say, except thanks. I consider it an honor to have known such a man.
One more thing, Stone. When you're in Texas and you need help, don't hesitate to call on the Rangers. Tell them you knew Captain Jennings. They'll remember.
Nathan rode north, his mind on the enormity of what he had just experienced. Having no particular destination in mind, he decided to ride to Fort Worth to renew his friendship with Captain Ferguson. Reaching Waco, he quietly took a room there for the night. He wanted no repeat of his last time there, when he had been forced to kill a bushwhacker. The beard he had grown as a means of hiding his identity had begun to bother him, and he shaved it off. He would take his chances on being recognized. Fort Worth, Texas, July 9th, 1874.
I'm sorry I had to be the bearer of bad news. I'm afraid the post surgeon had something to do with Captain Jennings' death. He felt it was his duty to tell the captain that he would never walk again, that there was no cure for the paralysis that had resulted from his being shot.
So, Captain Jennings had no other way out. He willed himself to die.
That's what the doctor thinks, but he had to be told.
I agree. There are worse things than dying, like lying on your back and able to get up.
It's good that you came this way. A friend of yours is here.
Byron Silver entered the room with a smile and shook Nathan's hand.
Byron Silver! Quit getting here and close the door. Every time I get near you, I got hombres throwing lead at me.
Well, hell, I try to get you to come to work in Washington. You'll still have hombres throwing lead at you, but the pay's better.
Excuse me. Duty calls.
Where's Cotton Blossom?
Nathan told his story and Silver shook his head.
I reckon life's hell on the frontier for just about everybody. It came as a shock, Captain Jennings cashing in. I'd have taken the time to come here if I'd known he was that bad off. Oh, damn shame him dying with neither of us here.
We didn't know just how hard that hit him, being laid up and unable to move. I reckon he took what seemed to him the best way out. I tracked down Clint Barkley, the varmint that ambushed him.
He was buried with military honors. By the way, I owe you one. I got off the train in Dodge the same day you scattered those wagon loads of Winchesters all over Kansas, Colorado, New Mexico, and Texas. Those gunrunners left St. Louis sooner than we expected.
Sorry I spoiled your fun, but when that 3rd wagon broke up, I saw the guns and they wouldn't let me go. They aimed to kill me and I decided not to hang around. Kind of took their minds off me when the wagons blew.
I dare say it did. Sheriff Harrington and me had just finished supper. He told me about some of the folks who have been gunning for you.
There have been a few misunderstandings.
Amigo, Sheriff Harrington and Dodge suggested something I believe you ought to consider. The AT and SF, the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe, is having a continuing battle with train robbers. They're wanting to hire a man to take charge of railroad security, and Sheriff Harrington told them about you.
I know. He mentioned it while I was there.
I believe you should consider it. Each time there's a payroll, you'd make the run from Kansas City to Pueblo, Colorado. You'd receive room and board and $500 a month. By the time law and order comes to the frontier, you'll be a rich man, amigo.
I don't need the money, and frankly, I don't care a damn about becoming a rich man. I don't know what I want.
Then maybe we should talk about something you don't want. What I'm about to tell you is in strict confidence and off the record. Comprende?
See.
In 1867, in a little Missouri town, Bart Hankins was shot to death during an aborted bank robbery by the James and Younger gangs. The shot that killed Hankins spooked the robbers, and they left the bank empty-handed. One of the gang was later captured and has sworn that none of the bandits killed Hankins. The Hankins family called in the Pinkertons, and it seems that after checking Army records, Hankins and six other men deserted.
I reckon that's how you learned what you're telling me.
Exactly. But that's by no means all of it. While the Pinkertons have been unable to account for all these six men, they have learned that at least one of them was gunned down in Denver. The law called the shooting justified, and nobody's contesting that. However, the Pinkertons are claiming there's a pattern, that the man who shot Bart Hankins may have killed his six companions. You, my friend, are a prime suspect. And the recent editorials in the Kansas City Liberty Tribune about the Pinkertons tracking you down so the Limbaugh woman could fill you full of lead haven't helped. You embarrassed hell out of the Pinkertons, and they'd like nothing better than nailing you on a legitimate murder charge. They aim to present your head on a platter to the Hankins family if they can.
And you think they can?
I don't know, but evidently they think they can.
Assuming they can, what does that have to do with me hiring on with the AT&SF Railroad?
If you're working security for the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe, the railroad will take a dim view on the Pinkertons harassing you. You'll have the railroad on your side, and it can be made to appear the Pinkertons are after you because of all those embarrassing newspaper stories. We don't know that they aren't, do we?
No, but I don't want others stopping my snakes, and that includes the railroads.
Damn it, shove that pride back in your pocket. You've learned what a $5,000 reward, unjustified, can do. If the Pinkertons can lay what even appears to be a legitimate charge on you, the Hankins family is prepared to offer a $10,000 reward for you, dead or alive. Are you prepared for that?
I reckon not, but why should the railroad stand up for me? I'm not the only hombre in the territory that's quick with a gun.
No, but your record of success with the Kansas Pacific stands mighty tall. There's nobody else around who can measure up to that.
Sometime back, I interrupted a holdup involving an AT&SF train, and the guards were Pinkerton men. Has there been a falling out?
You could say that. During the very next holdup, a Pinkerton man got nervous and shot a railroad brakeman. The thieves got away with the payroll, and that convinced the AT&SF the Pinkertons weren't worth a damn as railroad detectives. That and the train crew reminded the railroad brass that you alone with a Winchester had prevented a robbery and saved the payroll.
I felt a little sorry for the Pinkertons. They had told the railroad men the thieves wouldn't dynamite the baggage car, but when I arrived, there wasn't a hell of a lot of it left. I never saw anything in the papers about a Pinkerton man shooting a railroad brakeman, or of the Pinkertons being dismissed as railroad security.
The AT&SF hushed it up. It would have hurt the railroad's credibility and served no good purpose. However, if the Pinkertons are hell-bent on nailing you with a murder charge, the AT&SF might change their minds. That brakeman died, and while the railroad took care of his family, railroad lawyers could prepare one hell of a negligence suit. The Pinkertons could have a day in court they'll never forget, and in the process, forget all about Nathan Stone.
Silver, if I'm ever on trial for my life, guilty or innocent, I want you to plead my case. Why should I limit myself to an occasional bushwhacker on some lonely trail when I can be shot at 2 or 3 days a week all the way from Missouri to Colorado?
By God, you've got the straight of it. If I wasn't already in solid with the Federals, I'd root you out and take the job myself.
Now, do me one more favor. If the Pinkertons come up with charges that might put that $10,000 bounty on my head, get word to me.
I'll do that. I'll even go a step further. I'll wire Foster Hagerman of the AT&SF in Dodge. He'll go after the Pinkertons with a fistful of legal thunderbolts.
Damn it, Silver, I prefer that the whole world not know about this investigation. Don't be telling Hagerman anything, unless you have to.
He already knows the story, and he's quite familiar with the manner in which the Pinkertons tried to set you up for an ambush. You have friends, Nathan. Swallow some of that pride, and don't wait until you've been gut shot to allow some of them to help you.
The time spent at Fort Worth with Byron Silver had done wonders for Nathan. While he still missed Cotton Blossom, and always would, he'd accepted the fact the faithful dog was gone. Nathan rode west to Fort Griffin and north from there, avoiding Indian territory entirely. There'd been a major battle in the Texas Panhandle between buffalo hunters and Plains Indians. 28 men, with only an adobe ruins for cover, had driven away 700 Cheyenne, Kiowa, and Comanche warriors, led by the young Comanche chief, Quanah Parker. The ride from Fort Griffin to the Cimarron was more than 200 miles, and Nathan spent two nights on the trail, depending on his horses to warn him of danger. He breathed easier when he had crossed the Cimarron into Kansas territory. Dodge City, Kansas, July 29th, 1874.
Nathan! Good to see you again. You just missed a friend of yours when you were here last time.
I spent some time with him at Fort Worth, and he convinced me I should accept the railroad security position at the AT&SF. I'm supposed to meet Foster Hagerman here.
My God, will he ever be glad to see you. Three damn robberies in July and three lost military payrolls. Where's your dog?
Dead.
He again told the story, finding it less painful as he repeated it. Harrington was properly sympathetic.
You should meet Hagerman before you do anything else. He'll be able to get you a monthly rate at the livery. He keeps a few rooms reserved at the Dodge House. It's by far the best hotel in town.
The AT and SF offices were located in one end of the railroad terminal, and Nathan had no trouble finding Foster Hagerman.
Come in. Come in. I've been expecting you.
Silver and the damn telegraph.
And Mr. Silver understands our dilemma. I've delayed a payroll in Fort Leavenworth for about as long as I can. Are you prepared to take a train to Kansas City tonight and ride the baggage car back tomorrow?
I reckon. I'll need a hotel room for my belongings and a livery for my mount and my pack horse.
Here, take these papers. This one you'll present to the livery, the other to the desk clerk at the Dodge House. You have 2 hours before train time. Take your meals at Delmonico's. You have a tab there.
Just one thing more I need. When that payroll train heads west in the morning, I want you to be sure there's a caboose. In that caboose, I want a case of dynamite with sufficient caps and fuse.
But the payroll will be in the express coach.
Which is where it should be. And that's where the thieves will expect you to have a guard. Can you limit the train to four cars, the fourth being the caboose?
Yes. The brakeman will be riding with you.
Good. Will he have the sand to do what I tell him to do under fire?
He'll side you, up to and including gunfire if need be. He's Enos Pillpaw. His brother was a brakeman who was killed during a robbery last month.
Be sure there's a sending instrument aboard. I'll telegraph you if we need help repairing damaged track.
Nathan rode to the livery and left his horses. At his request, his saddle and pack saddle were stored in a tack room. From there, he went to the Dodge House and found his room. Dropping his saddlebags in a corner, he changed his mind and took them with him. Including the $4,000 he had won on the horse race in Uvalde, he had almost $6,000 in the saddlebags, too much to leave in a hotel room. He went to the Dodge City Bank and deposited all but $500. With that, what he had on deposit in the Kansas City Bank and the $500 from the railroad each month, he might never have to gamble again. Arriving in Kansas City 2 days later, Nathan was assigned a cot in a room directly behind the railroad dispatcher's office. There he lay awake far into the night, unable to sleep. Eventually, he slept until he was awakened at 6 o'clock by the dispatcher on duty.
Train time is 8 o'clock. Plenty of time for breakfast.
Nathan had breakfast in a cafe near the railroad depot and returned to the dispatcher's office at 7:45. The dispatcher was standing in the doorway.
That's your train on track 2, engine 338. Good luck.
Thanks. Taking his Winchester, he walked to the train. The door to the express car was open, and the expressman greeted him with a smile.
God, I'm glad to see you. I'm Art Raines, and I'm glad to have you riding with me.
Sorry, but I won't be riding with you. You'll expect that. I'm Nathan Stone, and I'll be in the caboose. I aim to see to it that they don't get to you.
Nathan went on to the caboose, climbed the metal steps, and opened the door. He was greeted by a young man who couldn't have been more than 22.
I'm Enos Pillpaw.
I'm Nathan Stone. I asked for some dynamite. Is it aboard?
It's here, with caps and fuse.
That cupola up there, is it open to the roof of the caboose?
It does, but it's glassed in. You can see in any direction with it closed.
That's good, but I'm going to need to reach the roof, and I don't aim to step out that door and climb the ladder.
The caboose lurched as the locomotive took up the slack. A trainman slid the express car's door shut and locked it. Slowly, the train began to move.
It's time to fuse and cap the dynamite.
He dragged the wooden box out from under one of the bench seats, and removing the coil of fuse, he began cutting what he hoped were 45-second lengths. He then fused and capped 2 dozen sticks of the explosive. From his shirt pocket, he took an oilskin pouch of matches.
I may need your help, Enos. If I need this dynamite, I want you to light the fuses one at a time and pass me the sticks until I stop you. Comprende?
Yes, sir.
I'm going to climb up there on that high bench so that I can see out. Do the outlaws usually stop the train by ripping up some of the track?
Well, they always have when I've been on this run. They usually come at us from behind the train. They'll leave one man to cover me and then move on to the express car. There's always a man within rifle range on each side of the engine, keeping the engineer and fireman covered.
Allowing them to dynamite the express car.
Yes, sir. The Pinkertons always rode inside the express car with the payroll.
This time I aim to stop them before they reach the express car. Does this train stop anywhere between here and Dodge?
There's a water stop at Wichita. Most of the robberies have taken place between Wichita and Dodge.
A pattern that was likely to continue, Nathan thought, but he couldn't count on that.
I have a Winchester, and I generally hit what I'm shooting at.
Keep it loaded and handy. If they get past the welcome I have planned for them, I'll need all the help I can get.
Reaching the outskirts of Kansas City, the locomotive picked up speed. For once, the flat, seemingly endless Kansas plain seemed a blessing.
40 miles an hour. Who would ever have thought a man would travel this fast? We'll be in Wichita in a little over 2 hours.
They were an hour out of Kansas City when the train crossed a bridge spanning a creek. Willows lined the creek, and from this cover, a dozen mounted men emerged. Two of them split off, well out of rifle range, one to each side of the train, their guns covering the fireman and engineer.
Enos, get 2 sticks of dynamite ready and prepare to light the fuses when I give the word.
They're ready.
On the riders came. Nathan waited until they were perilously close before opening the cupola hatch.
Dynamite, Enos.
Nathan held the explosive a few seconds until most of the fuse was consumed. He then flung the stick as high and as hard as he could. Enos handed him the second stick, and Nathan repeated the procedure. The first stick of dynamite detonated in the air above the mounted men. The second explosion came much closer to the target. Nathan climbed to the roof of the caboose with his Winchester. 5 of the outlaws lay on the ground, while the remaining 5 seemed dazed. 3 horses were down, the others galloped away. The 5 outlaws recovered their wits and began firing. Through the shattered glass and the back door of the caboose, Enos cut loose from his Winchester. Nathan bellied down on the roof of the caboose as lead cut the air just inches above his head. One of the attackers was hit, and in rapid succession, 2 more. The remaining pair turned and ran back the way they'd come. Lead struck the cupola, throwing splinters in Nathan's face. The 2 outlaws who had ridden ahead to cover the fireman and engineer were now firing at Nathan. He got to his knees and then to his feet. Over the tops of the railroad cars, he ran toward the outlaws, a colt in each hand. 1 man was hit, and slumping over in his saddle, he kicked his horse into a gallop. His companion, finding himself facing 2 blazing colts, galloped away to the north. Nathan continued along the tops of the cars until he reached the tender.
It's over, gents. Time to see how much damage they've done to the track.
My God, you drove that bunch away by yourself?
I had help. The young man in the caboose can shoot. 4 of those varmints escaped. 8 of them won't be going anywhere.
We'll have a look at the track. If they didn't damage the rails or ties, we can maybe patch up the track and go on.
Nathan went with the engineer and the fireman. Starting at a coupling joint, the outlaws had taken an axe to 12 cross ties, chopping away enough of the wood to withdraw the spikes that secured the rail. The rail had then been separated at the coupling joint, leaving enough of a gap to have derailed the locomotive.
You gents have almighty sharp eyes. How'd you spot this in time to stop the train?
I couldn't have done it without the help of the sun. When you're keeping your eyes on the rails, they're like 2 streaks of light. When 1 rail is twisted out of line, it's like a section of the light's gone out. I'm Collins, and my fireman's handy. Will you be riding shotgun with us on other runs?
For as long as you need me, I reckon. Can you repair this damage, or should I telegraph Dodge or Wichita for a work crew?
Those ties can't be used. If you telegraph Wichita, they can be here in maybe an hour. Tell them they'll need to replace 12 damaged ties. When you wire the dispatcher at Dodge, have him sidetrack the eastbound from Pueblo, giving us the main line. We'll be reaching Dodge at least 2 hours behind schedule.
I need the telegraph instrument and lineman spurs. I'm telegraphing Wichita to send a repair crew and Dodge City to sidetrack the eastbound.
Nothing to do now but wait. Lucky we took on wood and water at Wichita. At least we can keep up steam.
The work train, consisting of a locomotive, tender, and flat car, arrived an hour and a half later. It cost them another hour while the crew replaced the mutilated ties and spiked the rail back in place. Nathan and the firemen of the work train watched the repair crew go about their work.
Partner, there's 8 dead men back yonder behind our caboose. When you're ready to return to Wichita, load that bunch on your flat car. Tell the sheriff or marshal they're 2/3 of the pack of coyotes who've been stealing payrolls from the railroad. Some of them might be wanted by the law for other things.
An hour later, the 338 approached Dodge. The westbound waited on a siding, the engine keeping up steam as the 338 cleared the main line and rolled into the depot 2 hours and 45 minutes late. To Nathan's surprise, a crowd was waiting. Among them was Foster Hagerman, and he stepped forward to shake Nathan's hand.
I just had a telegram from Kansas City. The marshal at Wichita has identified 3 of the robbers. They were wanted by the law in Missouri. Damn fine piece of work, Stone. Take the next 3 days off. I'll talk to you again on Wednesday.
Hagerman may have moved off, but Nathan was besieged by the curious. Eli Kirby, editor of the town's weekly newspaper, the Dodge City Bulletin, pushed through the crowd.
Mr. Stone, you not only thwarted a train robbery, you accounted for 8 of the robbers. What do you have to say that I can print?
That we saved the payroll and accounted for 8 of the outlaws.
Yeah. But how? I want the details. Our readers will want to know how you did it.
So will other train robbers.
With that, he walked away. But he saw Kirby going after the 338's fireman and engineer. He wished he had cautioned Hagerman against allowing the trainman to talk about the robbery. For sure, the next band of train robbers wouldn't ride in, bunched for a greeting with a lighted stick of dynamite. Reaching Delmonico's, Nathan found Sheriff Harrington already there, drinking coffee and reading a copy of the Kansas City Liberty Tribune.
You're becoming a celebrity.
Not by choice. Damn it, this is all I need. There'll be gun throwers taking the train just to get a shot at me. I can hold my own with the outlaws. It's all the young fools who haven't started to shave looking for a fast reputation that bother me.
Well, I'll help you all I can. Any of them that show up here, I'll take away their guns, put them on a fast train, and send them home.
Oh, I'm obliged, Sheriff.
Dodge City, Kansas, August 5th, 1874. Foster Hagerman looked up at the clock on the wall of his office and felt some satisfaction that, like a good railroad man, Nathan was right on time.
Come in, Stone. Have a seat.
Hagerman shuffled through some papers on his desk until he found the one he wanted.
Saturday, you'll be taking the train to Pueblo. Monday morning, you'll take the eastbound for Kansas City. There'll be no passengers, with stops only for fuel and water. On board will be a shipment of more than $50,000 in raw silver. Need I say more?
My God, no. That's enough to draw every outlaw from the Trinity to the Yellowstone. But why are we taking this shipment? Most of the silver mines are near Denver. Why risk hauling that much silver 100 miles when the Kansas Pacific has a terminal in Denver, with a straight line through to Kansas City?
The Kansas Pacific has its share of holdups, too. The mines have taken to alternating their shipments, hoping to confuse the robbers. They managed to get their last shipment through on the Kansas Pacific, but they aren't willing to gamble on a second one. They believe they stand a better chance by wagoning the silver to Pueblo under heavy guard and having us take it on to Kansas City.
It strikes me thieves wouldn't have to be too bright to unravel a system like that. They must have some idea as to the time schedule when a shipment's ready to be sent east.
Well, you may be proven right. All we know is that it's worked so far, and until it fails, I suppose we'll continue.
How far is Pueblo from Kansas City?
A little more than 600 miles, including water and fuel stops, about 16 hours. If there are no delays, you should reach Kansas City about 10 o'clock Monday night. You can lay over until Wednesday and take 338 back here on Wednesday morning.
In between runs for the railroad, there was little to do except eat and sleep. Unless, of course, he started gambling again. But Nathan wasn't hurting for money, and he resisted the urge to go back into the saloons. Pueblo, Colorado, August 8, 1874. Nathan reached the town early Saturday afternoon. The silver shipment was already there, in a vault in the dispatcher's office. And besides the dispatcher, two armed guards were on duty around the clock. Nathan was hungry, and there was a little cafe, the Starlight, near the terminal. The Starlight seemed to be a gathering place for railroad men.
Nathan!
Nathan spotted the grinning crew of old 338. There was Dub Collins, the engineer, Amos Handy, the fireman, Enos Pilpaw, the brakeman, and Art Raines from the express car.
Drag up a chair. We ain't got a thing to do till Monday morning but eat and talk.
I reckon you gents are taking 338 back to Kansas City then. I'll be leaving at 6 o'clock Monday morning myself.
Oh, then you'll be riding with us. Oh, that makes me feel a sight better.
Me too. We've been told not to talk about that run, but I reckon you know all about it.
I know, and I'm glad you gents will be in charge of the train.
A waitress behind the counter had her back to Nathan, and he caught his breath, for her build and the flowing, curly black hair reminded him of Molly Tremaine. He kept his eyes on her until she turned around, and she had Molly's dark eyes and sensuous lips. His heart skipped a beat, and the look on his face must have given him away.
That's Melanie Gavin. She and her ma, Elsa, own this place. Mike Gavin was killed in a railroad accident, and Elsa used the money from the railroad to open a cafe. All the railroad men eat here, and the place never closes.
She's a beautiful woman, and she reminds me of someone I used to know in St. Louis.
You should have lured her into double harness. I just wish Melanie had took to a railroad man instead of the snake-eyed varmint that's sparking her.
And who would that be?
Cleo Shanklin. He owned Shanklin Freight Lines, hauling from here to Denver and from Denver back. His wagons brought in the shipment from the mines that's down at the dispatcher's office now.
So he knows about these shipments before they leave Pueblo?
He'd have to. What are you thinking?
I'm wondering just how trustworthy Shanklin is.
We can't answer that. All we know is that none of us like him.
Oh, damn. Speak of the devil.
The man who entered the cafe looked like anything but a teamster. His black boots were polished to a shine, accenting his black trousers and black frock coat. His fancy white shirt had lace at the cuffs. His broad black string tie was long and flowing, and topping it all was a pearl gray Stetson. The left armpit of the coat bulged just enough to suggest a shoulder holster. He seemed as phony as a pair of loaded dice, and Nathan immediately decided he didn't like Clell Shanklin either. Shanklin quickly gave them reason of plenty for their dislike. Although the cafe was almost full, Shanklin seized Melanie, bent the girl over backward, and showered her with kisses. She broke loose, her face flaming, and obviously had to restrain herself from expressing her embarrassment to him. Nathan was wishing mightily that she had floored the insensitive Shanklin, but she didn't.
God, I wish her ma would set her straight and send that greasy coyote back to the wagon yard.
Oh, hell, she's a grown woman. Likely 25 years old. Some gals never rise above greasy coyotes. Run one off and she'll snag the next one.
Nathan left the cafe with his four companions, separating when the railroad men decided to visit some saloons. He returned to the railroad bunkhouse and, despite the noises from the rail yard, managed to sleep. When he awoke, it was late, and some of the other bunks already had snoring occupants. As quietly as he could, he tugged on his boots, donned his hat, and buckled on his gun belt. Recalling that the Starlight Cafe never closed, he went there for supper. Except for a burly male cook and Melanie Gavin, the place was deserted. Nathan took a stool at the counter, and Melanie came to take his order.
I'd like a steak cooked all the way through with onions and potatoes on the side, and plenty of coffee.
You heard him, Cookie. I haven't seen you in here before.
I was here for dinner, but you were busy.
She stood there, her face scarlet, and averted her eyes. Nathan took pity on her and changed the subject.
I'm Nathan Stone. I'm with the railroad.
You look more like a cowboy than a railroad man. You must be one of the guards for that silver.
Her voice trailed off as she realized what she was saying. Abruptly, she turned away, filled a cup, and brought Nathan his coffee.
Yes, I'm with Railroad Security. I was in mind to have some words with Clell Shanklin. I'm told he spends a lot of time here.
That's none of your business. He has an office here in town.
I don't reckon I need to talk to him now. I've learned what I needed to know.
When his meal was ready, he ate, paid his bill, and left. He then crossed the street as though returning to the railroad bunkhouse, but took refuge in the shadow of some boxcars on a railroad siding. Not more than a few minutes after he had left the cafe, Melanie slipped out the door. She stood there a while as though undecided, and then set off up the street toward the lights of town. Keeping to the shadows, Nathan followed. When he reached the wagon yard, he waited until she had climbed the steps, crossed the dock, and entered Shanklin's office. Nathan reached the door in time to hear Shanklin's response to whatever the girl had told him.
Damn, you talked to him.
He asked about you and I.
Nathan had heard enough. He stepped through the door and found Melanie on her knees, blood trickling from the corners of her mouth. Shanklin stood over her, his lean face a mask of fury.
Get up and get out of here.
Shanklin turned on Nathan, his hand darting beneath his coat, but it wasn't nearly as quick as Nathan's fist. It caught Shanklin on the point of his chin, snapped his head back, and lifted his feet off the floor. He slammed into a wall, bringing down a mess of harness and gear that had been hanging on pegs. He slid down the wall and lay still. Nathan turned to find Melanie standing there, wide-eyed and trembling.
I told you to get out of here. Come on.
He took her arm, and she didn't resist. He said nothing more until they were on the street, making their way toward the cafe 2 blocks away.
You want to return to the cafe, or do you want to go home?
To the cafe. I don't want Mom.
You don't want her to know he hit you.
Through the back door.
He led her there, and from somewhere she produced a key, unlocking the door.
Now get inside and stay away from that freight office.
Come in. Please, I want to talk to you.
Not knowing what he might be in for, Nathan stepped inside. He found a seat on a bench in the cafe's kitchen, while Melanie bathed her face in cold water.
Now, what do you want to talk about?
Why are you after Clell?
I'm not after him, yet. He's told you things he should have kept in confidence, and I'm wondering who else he's told.
What do you mean?
You know damn well what I mean. Why do you think raw silver is being freighted all the way from Denver to be shipped to Kansas City? One word to a band of thieves and all this security would be for nothing.
And you're thinking Clell might sell that information.
I'm thinking that he could, and you're not all that sure that he won't, so you went to warn him, didn't you?
No.
Then why did you go?
That's none of your business.
I think it is my business. Obviously, he thought you must have told me something. Or does he just slap you around to amuse himself?
No, it's... Oh, just go. Please, go.
You wanted to talk, and I think you need to talk. You can reach me by telegram at the AT&SF terminal in Dodge City, Kansas.
Nathan looked around as he crossed the street to the dispatcher's office. There was no light, and the door was locked.
Who are you and what do you want?
Nathan Stone, security with the AT&SF. Just wanted to be sure there's nothing out of kilter.
We appreciate your concern, but we have everything in order.
Nathan went to the bunkhouse, vaguely uneasy. Melanie Gavin knew more than she was telling. Otherwise, why would Shanklin have reacted so violently when he learned Nathan had been questioning the girl? Nathan believed Clell Shanklin was already involved, or about to become involved, in some scheme that would jeopardize the silver shipment. But so far, he had only his suspicions. To Nathan's surprise, late as it was, the railroad bunkhouse was virtually empty. The 338's crew was there, however, and they were awake.
You should have been with us. Clell Shanklin come in the saloon with a bruise on his chin that was a real beaut. He was as riled as a stomped-on rattler.
Damn, I always miss out on the good stuff. Speaking of Shanklin, how long has he been hauling shipments from the mines to Pueblo?
We don't always make this run, but as far as we know, this could be Shanklin's first run. Last time we took a mine shipment to Kansas City, Shanklin wasn't doing the hauling. He took the contract away from somebody else on a low bid, I hear.
He's got a freight office here, so he's been around a while. That coyote's been sparking Miss Melanie for as long as I can remember.
Well, there ain't much hope for the rest of us when a slippery varmint like Shanklin can trap a pretty one like Melanie and keep her on his string. How in tarnation does he do that?
Nathan found himself wondering the same thing. Wondering if Melanie Gavin clung to Clell Shanklin to conceal a past she dared not have revealed. Clearly, she feared the man and had barely tolerated his embarrassing show of affection in the Starlight Cafe. Her relationship with Shanklin was one unanswered question. As to the other question of whether Shanklin was selling information to outlaws, Nathan had reached a decision.
Dub, tomorrow and tomorrow night, how many westbounds will there be coming from Kansas City?
Unless there's been changes, two. One pulls out of Kansas City at 6 in the morning, and the other at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon.
Is there a schedule for these mine shipments? Do they always go out on Monday?
They have so far. They arrive on Saturday and are loaded on the first train out on Monday. Why?
Because we're going to change that schedule this time. I'm going to telegraph Foster, Hagerman, and Dodge, and we're rolling out of here at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Hell, it's near midnight. The dispatcher's office is locked up tight, and them guards has got orders. That door stays locked until 7 o'clock in the morning, and then nobody goes in but the dispatcher. You can't send a telegram, and even if you could, tomorrow being Sunday, Hagerman likely won't be in the office.
Art, the last time I rode with you gents, there was a telegraph sending instrument in the express car. Is it still there?
Yes, and the lineman's spurs, too.
Well, I'll be needing them. Dub, do you have any idea who would be Foster Hagerman's boss?
Hell, I don't know, unless it's Pierce Malone, president of the railroad.
He'll do. I want those two westbound sidetracked tomorrow. The 6 o'clock departure at Dodge and the 2 o'clock departure at Wichita.
God, can you do that?
We're about to find out. The safety of that silver shipment may well depend on it. I want nothing said to anybody until I've heard from Kansas City. It'll take a telegram from Pierce Malone or Foster Hagerman to release that silver shipment, and I want not a word of this to get past the dispatcher's office.
You want the telegraph key and the lineman's spurs now?
Yes, and I'd appreciate you keeping watch while I'm up the pole.
Is there anything the rest of us can do?
Not right now. You'll need to get upstream in the morning and be ready to roll when the dispatcher gets word to release that silver shipment. For now, all I can do is hope there's a dispatcher on duty in Kansas City who's got the sand to wake up the president of the AT&SF in the middle of the night.
Kansas City, Missouri, August 9th, 1874. The sleepy dispatcher couldn't believe his ears. He'd remained in the office only because he had to be there at 4 when the trainman arrived. He doubted there was a railroad dispatcher anywhere who was on the line past midnight, and he hurriedly lighted a lamp. The instrument was signaling the same message over and over, requesting permission to send. The Kansas City dispatcher answered the request, and when the message came in, it was addressed to Pierce Malone.
Secured shipment leaving Pueblo at 6, Sunday morning, highballing, stop. Sidetrack, first westbound at Dodge, and second westbound at Wichita, stop. Confirm, stop. Nathan Stone.
Quickly, the dispatcher acknowledged. He then hurried out of his office, for it became his unpleasant duty to awaken Pierce Malone, president of the AT&SF Railroad, at 1 o'clock on a Sunday morning. A disgruntled butler answered the door and gave the dispatcher the response he expected.
Mr. Malone has retired for the night. He'll be in his office on Monday morning.
This can't wait until Monday morning. He must answer a telegram tonight. It's most urgent.
Please come in. You may wait here. I shall see if Mr. Malone is available.
Stone better be right about this.
Malone eventually appeared, and in anything but a good mood.
Just who is Nathan Stone, and where in hell is he? The dispatcher's office in Pueblo should be closed!
He's tied directly into the line, sir, and he knows the code as well as I do. I'm sorry to have awakened you, but if he's bringing a train east...
Ah, damn it, Higgins, you did the right thing. Wire Stone, tell him to get the hell off that pole and go to the dispatcher's office. I'll be in touch with him there within the hour. Then wire the dispatcher in Pueblo and tell him to let Stone in. Sign my name. Now get going.
He's taking long enough. Suppose he don't answer.
He will.
Within seconds, the answer came. Nathan responded. He then disconnected his patch and climbed down to the ground.
That was mighty short.
That was the dispatcher in Kansas City. He's contacting the dispatcher here, telling him to let me in. Malone will be in touch with me as soon as he can get to the dispatcher's office. Going back to the bunkhouse, and all you get what sleep you can. We'll be rolling out here at 6, highballing.
By the time Nathan reached the dispatcher's office, a lamp had been lighted, and the two guards eyed Nathan doubtfully. The dispatcher sat before the telegraph key, rubbing his eyes.
Mr. Malone's going to be mad as hell. This better be important.
It is, and I'm taking full responsibility. When Malone responds, step aside. I'll send my own message.
When Malone's message came, it was a question.
What is the purpose of your action?
Nathan's response was equally blunt.
Thieves know of Monday security shipment. Stop. Release shipment for 6 this morning, highball. Stop. Sidetrack first westbound at Dodge and second at Wichita. Stop. And take over. The next message should be for you.
Nathan read it as it came over the wire.
Pueblo dispatcher, release Monday security shipment. Stop. Authorize 338 departure at 6 this morning. Stop. Both westbound sidetracked per Nathan Stone request. Stop. Pierce Malone, President AT&SF.
My God, mister. You got some authority. Nothing like this ever happened before. I just hope 338's crew ain't out in the saloons. They won't be expecting this.
They're in the bunkhouse and they already know. I want the three of you to remain here until train time, and whatever happens, you are to tell nobody of this change in schedule. Comprende?
The dispatcher and the guards nodded. Nathan made his way back to the bunkhouse. Not surprisingly, the train men were still awake and curious.
Are we cleared?
We're cleared all the way to Kansas City. Order of Pierce Malone himself. The first westbound will wait for us on the siding at Dodge, and the second will take the siding at Wichita.
It'll take some time to build up steam. We have to be up at 4 o'clock, so why don't we just get up now? We can go over to the Starlight and have us some breakfast.
Just don't say a word about this change in schedule, not to anybody. If there's any questions, you've all been making the rounds of the saloons and worked up an appetite.
They dressed and left, leaving Nathan to stretch out on his bunk for the little time he had left for sleeping. When he awoke, Enos Pillpaw and Art Raines had returned.
It's a few minutes past 4. Dub and Amos are checking in with the dispatcher. Then they'll fire up old 338 and begin building steam. Amos can have enough steam to leave at 5 o'clock.
No, we'll stay with the schedule Pierce Malone accepted. We can't get past Dodge City before the first westbound takes the side in there unless you want to risk meeting it head on.
You're right. You're a better railroad man than I am.
At 5:30, Nathan, Enos, and Art left the bunkhouse and started for the train. At that point, Dub Collins put the locomotive in reverse and began backing toward the depot.
They're ready to load the express car.
This time there was the locomotive, the tender, the express car, and the caboose. Dub eased back until the express car was even with the dock outside the dispatcher's office. The silver was in heavy canvas bags, and after being brought to the dock, it was then moved quickly into the express car. Art entered the car, and Enos locked the sliding door. Nathan and Enos mounted the metal steps of the caboose as the train began to move. The sound of the train leaving the station awoke some of the guests at the hotel, Clell Shanklin and Melanie Gavin among them.
Damn.
It's only a train.
Only a train? Hell. By God, they're moving the silver that wasn't supposed to go until tomorrow.
You don't know that.
What else could it be? It's that damn Nathan Stone's doing. And you, by God, you made him suspicious.
I didn't. I want nothing to do with your schemes to steal from the railroad. And I'd be ashamed to have anyone know what I know about you.
5 years ago, when you was just 19, you didn't care what I'd done. Long as I come up with the money to get you to California. Changed your mind, have you?
When I was 19, I was a damn little fool. I let you take me, use me, ruin me. I wouldn't go to California with you or anywhere else for all the money in the world. Ma knew what you were, and she hated you. She hates you now. And if I got what I deserved, she'd disown me. Don't tell me any more of your sneaking low-down plans to take what doesn't belong to you. I didn't tell that railroad man anything, but if he asked me again, I just might spill my guts.
Damn you!
He ripped her gown off her and beat her, driving his fist into her belly, slamming his knees into her thighs and slapping her face. Finally, he kicked her out of the bed and she fell face down on the floor. He got up, seized her by the hair, and rolled her over to face him.
I hate you!
He drove his fist into her face, slamming her head against the floor.
You talk about me to anybody, and by God, I'll kill you.
Nathan kept watch from the caboose as the 338 roared through eastern Colorado. Once they passed through the state, there was little chance of a robbery. Thieves alerted by Shanklin likely wouldn't ride 150 miles to rob a train. 2 hours out of Pueblo, they made their first water stop.
We're in Kansas, for whatever it's worth.
It's worth a lot. This being an unscheduled run, I don't expect trouble from here on. How far are we from Dodge?
Little over 100 miles. We've been highballing, and that means we're going nearly 50 miles an hour. If nothing goes wrong, we'll be in Kansas City by 6 o'clock tonight. 12 hours. That's a damn good run.
Why cut back to 40 miles an hour on other runs?
Well, 50's too dangerous. On cloudy or rainy days and at night, visibility is poor. We have to travel slowly enough to stop if there's something on the track, or if there's a rail loose or a bridge out. Highballing can be a risk, even in the daytime.
Dodge is about halfway, so there's a chance we'll get there ahead of the westbound from Kansas City.
Yep. We could get there as much as an hour ahead of the westbound.
Then we'll have to take the siding and wait for them to pass.
No, we have priority, and they have their orders. We'll take on water and fuel there, and we'll wait on the main line for the westbound to take the siding.
338 reached Dodge City a few minutes before noon, and the westbound had not arrived, for the siding was empty. There evidently had been some communication between Pierce Malone and Foster Hagerman, because Hagerman was there when Nathan and Enos swung down from the caboose.
You're an hour ahead of the westbound. There's hot coffee in the dispatcher's office. Let's talk.
Nathan told Hagerman the little he knew and what he only suspected, concluding with the possibility that Clell Shanklin might jeopardize future shipments.
Well, I have no proof. I had nothing more than a gut feeling to justify the change in your schedule for this shipment. We might have waited until tomorrow and had it all come off without a hitch, but it didn't feel right to me.
This is why we hired you. And when your suspicions call for some changes in schedule, don't be afraid to make those changes. Incidentally, I got a telegram from Pierce Malone this morning commending you for your strategy in bringing in this shipment a day early with an 11th-hour change in schedule.
I believe I should spend a few days in Pueblo and either confirm or drop these suspicions regarding Shanklin.
I agree. Come up with some conclusive proof against Shanklin, and we can appeal to the mine owners to get rid of him, contract or no contract. Lay over in Kansas City tonight and take the 6 o'clock westbound back to Dodge in the morning. Oh, by the way, Malone canceled the 2 o'clock westbound for today, so when this oncoming train takes the siding, you'll have a clear track all the way to Kansas City.
By the time Nathan returned to the caboose, the westbound was pulling into the station. She slowed to a crawl, allowing the brakeman to swing down and open the switch. The 338 had taken on wood and water and was ready to resume the journey, freeing the main line for the westbound to leave on schedule. They pulled into Kansas City ahead of schedule.
Now that's what I call smooth. You know, the railroad ought to slip these mine shipments in at odd times, so that nobody knows which train they'll be on.
You're getting ahead of me. That's one change I aim to suggest, so I'd appreciate you keeping that possibility under your hat.
By the time Nathan had stepped down from the train, the dispatcher had spotted him.
So you're the gent that sent me to wake up the president of the railroad at 1 o'clock in the morning. God, I thought heads would roll, starting with mine. You, my friend, must lead a charmed life. Mr. Malone sent word for you to join him for supper tonight. I've written down the address.
Thanks.
Pierce Malone's home was everything Nathan had expected, and more. A two-story white house with green shutters, it sat on a hill a few miles south of town. He was shown into the parlor. He remained standing, for the furniture looked fragile and expensive. Malone entered the room and extended his hand.
I'm Pierce Malone.
I'm Nathan Stone.
Malone asked only enough questions to get Nathan started, and then he listened. He was told essentially what Nathan had already told Foster Hagerman. When Nathan had said about all he intended to, Malone drank the rest of his coffee and spoke.
I think I must commend Mr. Hagerman on his judgment. There's not another man in the employ of this railroad who would have taken it upon himself to make the moves you made last night and this morning. I only recently learned of the episode involving the dynamite and the saving of a military payroll that might otherwise have been lost to train robbers. There are times, Stone, when I feel those of us who are forever driving the rails westward are miscalculating our influence. We believe the coming of the rails parallels the advance of civilization, when that is rarely the case. I am referring to the lawlessness that prevails on the western frontier. The railroads, rather than having a civilizing influence, are creating a series of boom towns allowing criminals to rise to greater heights than ever.
Like the James and Younger gangs. Instead of robbing a bank and getting only a few $100s, they can hold up a train and escape with thousands.
Precisely. I suppose law and order will come, but not in my lifetime or yours.
We have law on the frontier now, but it's law in its rawest form. It's the law of the gun. Men like Wild Bill Hickok have stood for the law, only to have the good people turn on them and drive them away to face their enemies they've accumulated. Hickok will likely die in some frontier town, shot in the back with nobody to avenge his death.
And you, Nathan Stone?
Likely the same fate as Hickok. I'm riding for the brand, Mr. Malone. And in looking out for the interests of the AT&SF, I'm on the legal side of the fence. On the frontier, a man's enemies have no respect for the law, in whatever form it appears. I could be wearing the shield of a Texas Ranger, but I refuse to hide behind a badge. There are men who would gun me down just to prove they're faster with a gun. And the time may come when you'll curse me. The time may come when I'll have to shoot some fool kid to save my own life, when I have a price on my head, when the good people and the big newspapers are drumming up a legal lynch mob. Then, if not sooner, I'll be leaving you, Mr. Malone, for your railroad won't need the bad name.
By God, a man does what he must. As long as you're loyal to the AT&SF, I'll side you till hell freezes.
I believe you, Mr. Malone, and I'm obliged.
I mean every word. Thank you for this visit. I'll have someone take you back to the terminal in the buckboard.
In the bunkhouse that night, Nathan lay awake, pondering the railroad man's words. Might there be a future for him with the railroad, despite his deadly reputation with a gun? The uncertainty crept away, only to sink its teeth into him anew 3 days later, when Pierce Malone died in his sleep. Dodge City, Kansas, August 11, 1874. Nathan stepped down from the train on Tuesday and encountered Foster Hagerman.
You'll still want to spend some time in Pueblo, but I think there's been some changes in the situation there. A visitor arrived on the train a while ago and won't talk to anybody but you. I sent her on to the Dodge House.
When Nathan walked into the hotel, Melanie Gavin came to meet him. He almost didn't recognize her, for she wore a hat with a heavy veil.
Come up to my room, unless you fear for your reputation.
There's nothing either of us could do that would worsen my reputation. If I wasn't such a coward, I'd kill myself. But I need to speak to you.
Let's go.
Trail of the Gunfighter, The Killing Season is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1996, Ralph Compton, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2012, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Danny Gavigan, Thomas Keegan, Richard Rowan, Michael John Casey, Yasmin Toison, Christopher Graybill, David Coyne, Michael Glenn, Kimberly Gilbert, Jeff Allen, Scott McCormick, Dylan Lynch, Thomas Penny, James Lewis, Alexander Strain, Tim Carlin, Christopher Sheeran, Bradley Smith, Eric Messner, Elizabeth Jernigan, Tony Nam, Patrick Bussink, Bobby Aselford, Joe Brack, Johan Detweiler, Ken Jackson, James Konicek, Nick DePinto, Drew Kopas, Alyssa Wilmoth, Nanette Savard, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terrence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Book adapted for graphic audio by Catherine Aselford. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Patrick Stratton. With original music by Johan Detweiler. If you enjoyed Ralph Compton's The Trail of the Gunfighter, be sure to look for Elmer Kelton's Texas Rangers and Sons of Texas series. Available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net. where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, audio guides, and podcasts. Keep listening for previews of other thrilling titles in graphic audio.
Graphic Audio presents Lilith St. Crow's Jill Kismet.
Come on in and step right up, ladies and gentlemen! See the hunter come into the ring. Yes, sir. It's a sight for the ages. And tonight's show will be the one to end all shows. Hurry, hurry, find your seats.
Book 4. Flesh Circus.
Hola, bruja. Come in. Been expecting you.
The body shot forward, hitting the edge of the cornmeal circle, going full speed. When you want to talk about it, let me know.
You never have time.
You're kidding, right, Saul?
Do I sound like I'm kidding?
Don't worry about me, Saul. I did this job before you came along. Why don't you go and find a nice tabby and raise a litter or three? God knows you're domestic enough.
Jesus, Jill! Are you insane?
Darkness pressing down as if I were the thing to be exorcised from this house. One of the zombies leapt on me, and I struggled to free myself. What the fuck? I think Saul left me.
Left you? Why would...
Galena, my love life can wait. If Zomba kills who she's aiming for, there's gonna be heavy-duty problems. Because on the other side of the central ring, leaning forward as if pushing into a heavy wind, stood Mama Zomba.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Cirque Diabolique. We're all new and renewed. We're pedal to the metal and shoulder to the wheel. And welcome our new hostage. Time to clip and chain him.
You have our thanks, Hunter.
Available now in graphic audio.
Wanderer, I had a bad dream. I heard a voice calling me, Wanderer. I followed it through a dark mist until I saw wooden stairs built into the side of a huge mound. I walked up the steps into this big round room.
Ah, the Sun Chamber at the Temple Mound in Cahokia. I wonder what the Cahokians want with you. Theron, the Sun Chief, is not a good person to be wanted by. His madness started with Nightshade. Yes, Nightshade.
I hate this, Badger Tail. The Sun Chief has truly gone mad this time.
Theron frightens me too, but I cannot disobey my orders, Bobcat.
Leader Badger Tail wishes to speak with the great Moon Chief.
You're a bold man, Leader Badger Tail.
The Sun Chief needs a new priestess. He wants Nightshade.
She's not here.
Where is she?
We won't tell you. If you kill us, Nightshade will find you. She'll avenge us.
No! Father!
Pataga, you are the new Moon Chief.
So, you are mine again, Nightshade.
I had no idea you'd grown up into such a beautiful woman.
Why did you order me brought back here, Theron? What is it you've done to anger the gods so much that they've abandoned us?
Don't ever ask me that again. Do you understand?
Hail Cloud!
Yes, my chief?
How many warriors survived Badger Tail's attack?
He left us about 100. If you're thinking of returning his attack, don't. We can't.
How many warriors survived at Hickory Mounds and the other villages Badger Tail has ravaged this cycle?
Well, it might work, my chief, if we can convince their people to fight with little food in their bellies.
Pataga is massing forces, war leader. He has already gleaned over 900 from the southern villages.
We must stop Pataga now.
All right, but first, before you attack Pataga, I want you to strike Redweed Village and bring me the stone wolf that resides there.
But my chief...
I want that stone wolf! You will attack Redweed Village and get it!
Nightshade, tell me how to stop the killing. Can you?
No.
If you can't, who can?
A woman whom Wanderer is teaching. I don't know her name, but she's powerful. More powerful than I am.
Foe, grab Lycan! We have to try to get out through the window!
But they'll be watching. You know they will. They're probably waiting to...
Bull!
Mother! Where's my mother?
I can run!
What happened?
Run! We'll fight you if we can!
Locust, what have you discovered?
About the stone wolf? Nothing.
Wanderer.
Badger Tail. It's been a long time.
Tell me where the wolf is.
No.
Why?
The wolf is a very great power object, but I will tell Nightshade.
Birdman, 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 help me stay awake. I have to wait for Wanderer or my mother.
I hear you, little one.
Oh, Birdman, thank you.
Do you know why owls die with their wings outspread, little one?
They know that flight is their only hope of survival.
Will you give up, Lycan, or will you fly for your people?
I want to fly, Birdman! I've always wanted to! Birdman, no! You're supposed to be my spirit helper!
Against the stunning backdrop of one of the greatest cities of the ancient world unfolds an epic tale of madness and revenge, of passion and redemption. Don't miss the next exciting installment of the North America's Forgotten Past series, People of the River, in rich, vibrant, graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.